So good morning, everybody. Good to be here together. And I said to one of the children, do you think it's going to be Noah's flood again? And he said to me, no, we're not going to have one of those again. Isn't that great when the kids know that? And we're not. So we're going to be talking the next step in. Are you ready, John? We're going to be talking about our next stage in the series in Numbers. And we're doing Numbers because it's in the Bible. Well, that's a reasonable reason. But also because there are lessons that we can learn for it for us today. And particularly relevant to our particular stage in our church journey, when we're thinking about our pilgrimage, when we're thinking about where we've been and where we are and where we're going. And so I hope you'll find that there are some lessons that are relevant to us as we think about who we are and what we're here for. So, like Nigel said, for next week, we've got two chapters here, and it's too much to read all the way through. So hopefully you'll have been aware that that's what's coming, and you'll at least have taken a sneak preview. But I hope to just summarise these two chapters, and then we're going to take a focused look in two particular areas. But I thought we'd just start with a recap or a reminder of what we had last time. I don't know if you watched these soap operas. And when they're complicated and there's a little bit of a break from the last time, you get a kind of a previously in Numbers. And so I thought I'd just do that. But Steve gave us a great sort of recap starting almost from the book of Genesis last week. So I thought I'd start with where Steve started. Who can remember what happened in Numbers 13 and 14, which is what we looked at last week? Well, the Israelites turned up on the brink of entering the Promised Land. But what? What happened last week? Sorry, who now?
They lost their nerve.
They lost their nerve, that's right. So they sent some spies in to take a look at the land, 12 of them, and 10 of them came back and said, well, it's quite nice, but... And two of them said, yes, we can do this. And they listened to the 10 and didn't listen to the 2. So God had a view about that, and God judged them in a particular way. What was God's judgment, God's response to that, when they said, we can do this, actually I don't think we will. They're all going to die. It's a bit heavy, isn't it? But they're all going to die in the wilderness, and it's going to take 40 years for that to happen. A whole generation of people, 600,000, slightly more than that, men above the age of 20, and the fighting men, and obviously all the women and children and non-fighting men, perhaps a million people. And God says, well, if you won't go now, you won't go at all. So then they said, right, let's go then. Okay, and they all went off and they thought, right, well, we're going to do this now then. And so what happened?
They got duffed up,
yes, exactly, by our old friends, the Amalekites and the Canaanites. And they stopped them going, big defeat, and they thought, oops. Maybe God's right. Some of them died that day, and then off they went off, and they turned south and disappeared. Okay, two. Those were the easy questions. Two slightly more difficult questions. Relevant though. Where did this happen? In the desert, yes. I know you know, Steve, but that's. See if they were listening to you. Anybody got an idea of the name of the place where they were when they got the report from the spies and decided not to go? You can flick if you want to have a quick look. It's in Numbers 13. Steve? Kadesh, very good. Kadesh or Kadesh Barnea, yes, it's a place just to the south of the Promised Land, and that's where this happened. All right, a slightly more difficult question again. When did this happen? I don't want the exact year, but in relation to, let's say, the big event that all of Jewish history is kind of arranged around, which is the Exodus. Roughly, where does this event happen in relation to the Exodus? 18 months to 2 years. It's actually within the second year. So we know that if you look in Numbers, in fact, the very first verse of Numbers, it says that the Lord spoke to Moses on the first day of the second month of the second year. So we start in 2 years after they had come out of the land of Egypt. And then again in chapter 9, the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai the first month of the second year after they come out of the land of Egypt. So that's the beginning of the second year. And then we go from 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. And those things happen fairly quickly. So we're somewhere within 2 years after the Exodus. Okay. Now, Steve very kindly finished his talk by saying, if you want to know what happened next, well, David will be talking about that next week. But I'm not. Because this week, we're talking about 20 and 21. So we're kind of missing out 15 to 19. So let's just ask a few questions about this gap. Where are we in Numbers 20 and 21? Any idea? It's quite easy, really. It starts in the first verse. The wilderness of Zin, or Sin, and the name of the actual place? Oh, Kadesh. Oh, hang on. We've been here before. We're in this place called Kadesh, which is actually where they were when Numbers 13 and 14 happened. When is this happening? Do we know? Well, there's a little clue, because in this chapter we've got the death of Aaron in verses 22 to 29. And very helpfully at the end of Numbers, it's in chapter 33, we have some hints about the sort of overall timing of what happened. Numbers 33 kind of summarises the whole book. And if you look at Numbers 33 and verse 37, it says they came to Kadesh, or they set out from Kadesh and camped at Mount Hor on the edge of the land of Eden. Aaron the priest went up Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there. When? In the 40th year after the people of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, on the first day of the fifth month. So now we are 40 years after the Exodus, which means 38 years after what Steve told us about last week. Now, God had said, over the next 40 years, you're going to wander in the wilderness. 2 years to go, right? We're at the end of this kind of period of wandering around. And what's actually happened? What have we missed in that 38 years? Well, not surprisingly, what God said happened. So we found, if you look in Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 14, which is Moses kind of giving a kind of summary of what's going on. He said, the time from our leaving Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the brook was 38 years, until the entire generation, that is the men of war, had perished from the camp as the Lord had sworn to them. For indeed the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from the camp until they had perished. 38 years. And 600,000 fighting men had died in the wilderness. Where did they bury them all? I mean, it's awful, isn't it? And obviously, lots of other people had died as well over those 38 years. It's not a nice place to be in the wilderness. They were wandering around, and they didn't have a lot of food and water, and not a lot of shelter. And people died. Maybe a million people had died in 38 years. I wonder how many were left. Do you think we know how many were left? Numbers 26. Verse 51, I don't know if Nigel will come to this, might do, but there is another kind of count towards the end of the book of Numbers. And so they have another count just before they go in. And if you look at Numbers 26:51, there's a kind of summary. This was the number of the people of Israel, 601,730. So actually, there's still over 600,000 fighting men, these are the men over the age of 20, in the new generation. It's been a complete replacement of the people who got to Kadesh, who God intended to take into the land of Canaan. Fantastic land. The spies came back with all of the fruit and everything. They said, we can do this. And they said, oh, I don't think so. No. Big people, you know, lots of fortified cities. Let's not. And so God replaced the entire generation. Well, nearly. Not quite everybody, because there are obviously still going to be some left. And now here they are, back in Kadesh. Back in the same place, with a second chance, with another opportunity to enter Canaan, the promised land that God had promised to them. I wonder how you think they felt coming back to this place 38 years later. Now, what was their view of this place where these things had happened, a place of failure, a place of curse? And the big question, how are they going to respond this time? Is it going to be different this time, or is it going to be more of the same? So it's quite a significant point. We've missed out a huge chunk. We've missed out 38 years. If you want to know some of the details, some interesting things did happen in that time, then go back and read 15 to 19. But now we're going to look at what happens, the kind of repeat of when Steve shared with us. Here we are back again at Kadesh, 38 years later, another million people, most of them are different, facing the same challenge, facing the same opportunity. What will they do? Okay, well, here's the passage that we've got, and I'm just going to summarise it really, really quickly, and we're going to come back to a couple of the incidents in this passage and just focus on those and try and draw some lessons specifically from them. But one interesting little sort of starting point is right at the beginning of Numbers 20, we just have a milestone, something important. And it says that Miriam, this is Moses' older sister, who looked after him when he was a baby and found him in the bulrushes, and Pharaoh's daughter brought him in, and his sister said, "I'll look after him." Miriam, who was with them in the wilderness and was leading the women in worship after crossing the Red Sea. Miriam, who was supporting Moses and with the brother Aaron as well, who formed this kind of triple leadership of the people in the wilderness. And she dies, and the people mourn for her. And that's just a little footnote. By the way, this starts with Miriam dying. Interesting. And then we have a period of complaint. What sort of complaints? So people say, no water. Have we heard that anywhere before? And there's an event where God actually provides water. But along the way, Moses and Aaron do something awful. And God judges them. We'll look at that in detail in a little bit of a moment, so a little bit later. Then they decide that they're going to go straight for Canaan, straight for the Promised Land, and they head due north. The problem is there's a kingdom in the way, and the kingdom of Edom, and so they say, okay, let's just go, but we better be careful. Let's just ask for permission to go through this land. And unfortunately, the king of Edom says no. So they say, well, are you sure? And so he sends his army out and says, no, I'm really sure. If you come through here, you're in trouble. I'm going to fight you. So what they do is they turn around and head off in the other direction. This is sounding horribly like 38 years ago when they tried it and failed and they headed off in the wrong direction. Then we've got another event, quite important in terms of the life of the nation. Aaron, who was the first high priest, Moses' older brother, and he dies. And we've just seen in Numbers 33 that was so important that it was picked out as an event in that summary of all the things that happened. So Aaron dies. Miriam's died. Aaron dies. And then we get into chapter 21, and there's a fight. This time, unusually, the Israelites win. They defeat Arad, which is the kingdom of the Canaanites in the Negev, in the desert, in the south of the Promised Land. And so that's a good start. Something's different here. The first victory they've had on their way since they left Egypt. Something's changed. Actually, not everything's changed, because then the people complain again. No water and no food, and it's not like we thought it was going to be. And so God judges them, this time not with being condemned to die in the wilderness, but he sends a whole bunch of poisonous snakes. And we'll look back at that in a moment. And there's a lovely story about how they're healed from the bite of the poisonous snakes through a metal picture, a metal image of a snake held up on a pole. Interesting. Very strange. The passage continues with them travelling around, and they're on their way to Moab. Along the way, they defeat two other kings. One of them is Sihon, the king of the Amorites. Sounds like they kill you by loving you, doesn't it, the Amorites? But I don't think it's really that. They didn't speak Latin in those days, did they? And then Og, lovely name, Og of Bashan, some people think it was his bed, but it was probably his sarcophagus or his coffin, was 13 and a half feet long, made of iron. We know where it is today. It says in the Bible, you can go and visit it if you like. He was one of the last of the giants. And so we've got all sorts of things have happened in this period. But it is actually a transition point. It's a turning point in the life of the nation of Israel as they're becoming. Because they left Egypt. They went straight to this sort of border. Things didn't work out. Wandered around for 38 years. All of the fighting men died and quite a lot of other people died. And they've come back round to where they were before. And now they've got another chance. And things are different. Including defeating some of these Canaanites. That had never happened before. So what we've got here is a period of something beginning to change. Like this quote from Churchill in 1942, this is not the end. It's not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. Something is changing in the life of the nation of Israel. And it's an important transition point. After their first arrival at Kadesh and failure to enter Canaan, God now says they're going to wander in the desert for 40 years and die. They're back at Kadesh 38 years later, and we find them moving towards Canaan and defeating the Canaanites and defeating others along the way. They're not there yet,
but they're on the way. And it is a key moment, a transition point. Beforehand, they failed. Now they're back. And what's going to happen next? So that's where we are in the story. What I want to do is to leave that story to one side. It's given us the kind of the big context, and pick up on two particular events that I think are dramatic, that are told us in some detail, and which are things that we can learn some lessons from for ourselves. So which of those two events do you think it's going to be? Which two events shall we focus on? Shall it be the death of the guy with the big bed? Or shall it be... Well, let's talk about these two. No surprise, really, is it? And we're going to talk about, first of all, the story of water from the rock. Why are we going to talk about that? God had done miraculous provision of water before. We're going to talk about that because it resulted in the death of Aaron and Moses, which is interesting. I mean, again, a key moment in the life of Israel, a key transition point where these two leaders who had done so well, something goes wrong, and it ends up with God judging them. So we need to look at that and find out what that was and what they did and what we should learn from that. And then the other thing is this incident of complaining again, I keep complaining, and God sending the snakes. And the amazing response or solution that God offered them to deal with these poisonous snakes that he'd sent. So those are the two incidents we're going to have a look at. So let's start with water from the rock. And this is in Numbers 20, verses 1 to 13. But first, let's just look very quickly at this thing about the death of Miriam. I'm going to put the verses here for those of you who don't have Bibles in front of you, just so you can see what it's about in detail. In the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, stayed at Kadesh, and that's where Miriam died. Exodus and Numbers, which is really a kind of a two-part history, seems to describe, as I mentioned, this shared leadership with Moses and Aaron and Miriam, each taking very significant but different roles. And when God pronounced judgment on Israel the first time when they refused to enter Canaan, he said they will all die in the wilderness except for Caleb and Joshua. And we've seen that over the next 38 years, all the fighting men died, quite a lot of other people died. But here we still have Moses and Aaron and Miriam, still leading the people, still alive at this point. And I just wonder if maybe they were slightly tempted to think, you know, God judged all the people, but we're still here. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. We're still here. That's all right, isn't it? Maybe, just maybe, we're going to escape. Maybe we're going to make it. Do you think it's possible we're going to get there into the promised land? Now, God had said, everyone will die except Caleb and Joshua. And the three key leaders are still there. Now, I don't know. We haven't got any evidence for that. Well, actually, we have a little bit of evidence for that in Moses' last conversation with God, when he says, I know you said that, but can I just pop over into the Lebanon? Would it be all right if I just went over the border just to see the land? And God said, I've said what I've said. There was that hint that Moses was just thinking about maybe he could get out of it somehow. But here we have the death of Miriam, recorded as a key event in this story of the nation of Israel. And I think it shows that leaders are not exempt, that they're members of the body, we're leaders of people, you know, part of the community, and God's standards apply to them and God's judgments apply to them. And when God says something, it applies to us all. Leaders are just us, doing a very difficult and a key role. And, you know, set aside, set apart and anointed. But God still judges all of us, and we all stand equal before him. So Miriam died. What about Moses and Aaron? Well, the answer to what happens to Moses and Aaron comes at the end of this passage about water from the rock. So let's have a look at that. Here we go again. The people complain. They just don't seem to learn, do they? It seems to be a theme throughout the entire Exodus Numbers story, complaining about a lack of water. Every time so far, God has provided. So we've got Exodus 15, the story at Marah, God provided water. Exodus 16, back in this desert of Zin, God provided quail and manna. Exodus 17 at Massah, God provided water. Numbers 11 that Barry told us about, God provided quail, loads of them, thousands, millions of them, so many that they were sick of them, literally, but God provided. And now here we are again, back at the same place, and the people are still saying, we haven't got any water. It would have been better if we had died when our brothers fell, when they were judged by God. It would have been better if we hadn't made it, if we'd have died with them. Why did you bring us here into the wilderness that we and our livestock should die here? There's no grain, no figs, no grapevines, no pomegranates, and no water. So, what does God do? God listens, and God has an answer. So we find in verse 6, Moses and Aaron go to the entrance of the tent of the meeting, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord told Moses what to do. Take the staff, that's the rod of Aaron which had budded, which was kept in the tabernacle. Now take the staff, you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together, and speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. And you will bring water out of the rock for the community, so they and their livestock can drink. Nice and straightforward, okay? Take the rod as a symbol of authority. Get everybody together so they can see what's happening. They all need to see this because it's going to be a miracle of my provision. Speak to the rock and the water will come out. Great. Nice and clear. Off goes Moses and Aaron with a plan. They know what God's told them to do. So what do? Well, this is what they do. Moses took the staff. Oh, yes, that's step one. Get the rod. Just as he commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together. Yeah, good. That's what we were told to do in front of the rock. And then Moses said to them, listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock? And Moses raised his arm and he struck the rock twice with the staff. It's fine because water gushed out, lots of it, enough for the community and the livestock to drink. So it worked. They got what they needed. Interesting. He didn't actually do exactly what God had told him to do. So there's a few little differences. I highlighted the words here. Take the staff, gather the assembly, speak to the rock. What did he do? He took the staff, gathered the assembly, spoke to the people and struck the rock. Very, very minor detail. You know, I mean, it's sort of more or less the same thing, isn't it? So what does God think about that? Is everything okay? Not really. And we find here in verse 12, God said to Moses and Aaron, and this is linking in with what Richard just said to the children, because you did not trust in me enough to honour me. That's the word that Richard used. Honour me as holy in the sight of the Israelites. You will not bring this community into the land I'm giving them. What? Excuse me, God. They've got a problem. We brought it to you. You told us what to do. We did that. A few little creative variations towards the end, but it worked. They got the water. And you're saying that we've done something wrong, that we didn't trust you, we didn't honour you, and we can't get into the promised land? That's a bit harsh, isn't it? You know, there was a problem, we fixed it. And we came to you and we asked and we did what you said, mostly, added a little bit, but what's the problem? And this was the waters of Meribah, the place of contention, where the Israelites quarrelled with the Lord, and something else important happened. He was proved to be holy before them. They saw something. They recognized God was holy. Holiness is a key feature of this passage. So what we need to do is find out what they did wrong. What was the problem with what Moses and Aaron actually did that resulted in these harsh words, or apparently harsh words, from God, a judgment? Well, God actually has given them very precise instructions. He said, take the staff, gather the people, speak to the rock. What they did was, took the staff, gathered the people, and spoke to the people, and struck the rock. And that seems to be enough of a difference for God to comment on, for God to respond to, for God to judge them in a way that is really a big judgment, a big deal. That these two men, who you remember all that they'd done with Pharaoh, you know, being faithful and said what God wanted them to say and got the people out of Egypt and formed them up into a nation and gave them the law and represented them before God and all of those things that Moses and Aaron had done, they're not going to get into the promised land because they did this thing. They spoke to the people and struck the rock instead of just speaking to the rock. That's the only difference. It can't be just that. Well, if you look previously in the story, there's lots of incidences of how Moses and Aaron had done exactly what God had commanded them or asked them to do. Exodus 7, verse 6, for example, this is the plagues. Moses and Aaron did so. They did as the Lord had commanded them. Exactly. They did what he asked. Towards the end, Exodus chapter 40, verse 16, the building of the tabernacle. It could be in here somewhere. Thus Moses did according to all the Lord had commanded him. So he did. And you'll find it repeated again and again and again that these guys were characterized by doing exactly what God had said. But this time they didn't. And we've got some commentary on this that might be helpful. And it might be that there are some indications for us and those of us who, you know, as I said, take the difficult challenge of leadership. There are some lessons here for how leaders should respond. Let's look at Psalm 106. Psalm 106, verse 32. This is another, there's a couple of review psalms which just go through all of the things that happened with the Israelites and then comment on them. And this is one of them. We'll look at the other one a little bit later. But Psalm 106, verse 32 says, "The people angered him at the waters of Meribah, and it went ill with Moses on their account." Moses got into trouble because of the people. "For they made his spirit bitter, and he spoke words that were rash." See, Moses said, "Listen here, you rebels. You know, you can hear the anger, you can hear the frustration, and even if you can't, we've got the commentary in Psalms that says his spirit was bitter and his words were rash," written by somebody who knows. And the Holy Spirit knew Moses and knew his motivations, knew both his actions and his attitudes, and comments on them in the Psalms. Bitter spirit and rash words. He was expressing anger and frustration. Then we've got this interesting thing where God's providing. And what did Moses and Aaron say? They said, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" They were putting themselves in the place of God as the source, as the provider. You know, look here, we've got to look after you lot. They were saying, "We're the ones who are the source," pointing to themselves. And then striking the rock. Well, what's wrong with striking the rock? He'd done it before, actually, in Exodus 17. And it worked before. Took the rock, took the rod, struck the rock, and the water came out. Maybe he just thought, well, it worked once before, we'll have another go. You know, same sort of, I've got the rod here, here's the rock, I need the water, I know what we're supposed to do, strike. God had told them to speak to the rock, exercise authority, and then it will clearly be a miracle of God's provision. And there's the idea that if you struck it twice, maybe that's an indication again of that sort of frustration. He didn't just whack it once. The problem is in both their actions and their attitudes. Actions, they didn't actually do precisely what God had told them. And attitudes, there's a judgment from God. Actually, if we look a little bit further on into verse 24, at the death of Aaron, God says, "Aaron shall be gathered to his people. He shall not enter the land which I have given to the people of Israel, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah." Moses said to the people, "Listen here, you rebels." And God said, no, you rebelled. You're the ones who are rebelling, not the people. Because I've told you to do something, and you didn't. Both of you rebelled against my command. So not obeying precisely what God says, in his view, is the same as rebellion. Even though it got the right result. They got the water, the people had what they needed, enough for all the livestock as well, you know, a million people, all of the cattle, that's a lot of water. It worked, but they didn't do it God's way. And God judged them for it. And what he said was, they did not trust him enough to honour him as holy in the sight of the people. That was his judgment, his view of their attitude. They did what they did not out of trust or a desire to honour God as holy. They had another motive, and God knew what that motive was. He is the provider. He is Jehovah Jireh. And God says Moses and Aaron didn't trust him to provide. They tried to do it in their own strength. They tried some of their own good ideas. They added to what God had told them to do. And his judgment on them was to include them in the general judgment on the people of Israel: you're not going to get into Canaan. So they were counted with the rest of the people. It had already happened to Miriam. It happened fairly soon for Aaron in verses 22 and just after that, 22 to 29. Comes a little bit later for Moses. You'll see at the end of Deuteronomy, chapter 34. But Moses and Aaron and Miriam died in the desert. And what God said came true. Only Caleb and Joshua made it into the promised land. So what was the result? I think it's very important, the last verse in this passage that we're looking at, verse 13. These are the waters of Meribah, the waters of contention, where the people of Israel contended with the Lord, and he showed himself holy. He showed himself to be holy by the way that he judged Moses and Aaron. He said, you can't muck about with me. If I tell you to do something, you need to do something. You need to do precisely what I tell you to do, with the right actions and the right attitudes. Moses and Aaron didn't honour God as holy, so he did it himself. He showed himself to be holy. The people are ultimately left in no doubt God is serious. When he says something, they should do it. And even Moses and Aaron are not exempt from that. So we find that this really is the end of the beginning in this transition point for the people of Israel. All of the leaders have gone. Miriam, Aaron, and Moses is under judgment. He's going to go soon. They're still facing the opportunity of getting into the promised land. The promise is still there. They're going to have to do it in a different way. What do we learn from this? Well, here's just a little picture. The picture's changed here. You just might be interested to know that some people think they might have found the rock, the actual rock that Moses might have struck. It's 60 feet high. It's about 15 miles north of this place called Kadesh. It's in a place where there's about half an inch of rainfall a year, and there's huge evidence of water erosion just below where this rock is situated, and all of the rest of the hillside above it is blackened as if there's been some kind of explosion and the rock's sort of melted and black. You know, it's a rock in the desert, but maybe it might be the one, who knows? It doesn't really matter, does it? Because the point is, God has proved himself to be holy. And interestingly, the place they were has a significant name. They came to Kadesh, God said, in you go. They said, no, I don't think so. Judgment. They came back to Kadesh 38 years later, and God said, right, in we go. And I'm going to tell you something important, and they don't obey, so God shows himself to be holy. What does the word Kadesh mean? It means holy. It's the place of holiness. I think that's significant. It's a little echo for those who, you know, when they know the language, they know the meaning of the name of the place. So the theme of holiness is hidden throughout the passage in lots of different places. Holiness is the entry point to the promised land. It's that turning point, the place where the Israelites had to get to in order to start to enter into Canaan. The first time they failed to trust God, failed to get into the land, wandered in the desert. Eventually they come back again to the place Kadesh, the place of holiness. God challenges Moses and Aaron to honour him as holy. They don't, so he does it himself. He shows himself as holy at Kadesh. Now they're ready to move forward. And it's the same for us. You know, we are challenged with the holiness of God. So there's this amazing passage in 1 Peter, chapter 1, which has these incredibly difficult words, which says, don't be conformed to the passions of your former ignorance. As he who called you is holy, be holy yourselves in all your conduct, for it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. And in the Greek, it's quite interesting, that could be a command, you shall be holy, for I am holy, or it could be a promise, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Either way, it's a challenge. And linking holiness to obedience, which is what happens with the story of Moses and Aaron and the water, is an important challenge for us. We can't just do things our own way. Obedience is not optional. Two other things just to say, and we might want to look at these in your own time. Hebrews 3 and 4 are commentaries on this, quoting Psalm 95, just telling us what we should and shouldn't do, what lessons we should learn from these incidents in the desert. And there's a couple of passages, verse 12, Hebrews 3:12, take care, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil and unbelieving heart leading you to fall away from the living God. We need to just take care and look at our hearts, examine our motives, not just our actions, but our attitudes. And for Hebrews 4, verses 9 to 11, so there remains a rest, a Sabbath rest for the people of God. Let us therefore strive to enter into that rest so that no one falls by the same sort of disobedience that they had in the desert. Okay, so the challenge is there for us. And in Psalm 78, which is the other one of the review psalms, and it's one of my most favourite psalms. I mean, I know they're all lovely. But the thing about Psalm 78 is that it tells us why we should teach our children. I think Sue mentioned this last week, and she quoted it from verse 3, 4, 5. She started saying, you know, we need to teach our children what God has done. Why do we teach our children? In verse 6, so the next generation might know the things that God has done and arise and tell them to their children, so they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God but keep his commandments. And Sue stopped there. Actually, it doesn't stop there. So there's a positive reason for teaching our children and for looking at these things, so that our children and we should remember what God has done and not be disobedient, but we should not forget the works of God and keep his commandments. And verse 8, they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation whose heart was not steadfast and whose spirit was not faithful to God. And I say to my kids, you know, I'm very sorry that you're like me in some ways. I want you to learn the good things, but not be like your father in a way that I'm stubborn and rebellious and my spirit is not faithful to God. Please learn from the good things, remember those things, but also learn from the bad things and don't copy me in the things where I failed. And that's what Psalm 78 says. We might tut at the Israelites that they failed to get into Canaan the first time around, or when they kept complaining, or when they refused to believe God's promises or honour him. But we're the same. We're like-minded, flawed people, and we make the same mistakes. And the challenge for us is to be trusting and faithful and obedient and give honour to God as holy. So, important. Let me just quickly talk about this other important story, and I'm going to be more quick on this one because there are some things that I think we know about it. So, snakes, snake trouble, and it's in chapter 21. There's another challenge for God's people almost immediately after this pivotal moment in their history where they get the water but they lose their leaders. And it's this thing where it starts yet again with a complaint. They're in the same old ways. They're impatient along the way. They spoke against God and against Moses. Aaron's gone by this time. Why have you brought us up again out of Egypt to die? No bread, no water, and we hate this miserable food, by which they mean the miraculous manna. They hate it. God's been providing. And so God punishes their complaining. Again, I mean, this is just repeating, isn't it? We're getting the same story because it's in their hearts. It's in their nature. God punishes them this time by sending poisonous snakes that bite the people and many of them die. Now the word actually for poisonous or venomous, in some versions of the Bible it says fiery or flaming, and it is thought that they probably were red. And actually the word fiery or flaming is used as the name of the species, the name of the type of snake that they probably would all have known. It's known as the fiery one. Either because it was red or because when you bit it you got sort of nasty inflammations and you went red. But it's the red snake, that's what they're saying, the flaming snakes. And God sent them, and a lot of people died. Pretty harsh judgment for complaining about water. So what do they do? Go to Moses and say, help. And what does Moses do? Moses goes to God and says, help. Good thing for leaders to do. And the Lord gives him an answer. Make a model of the snake and put it on a pole. Anyone who's bitten can look at it and live. Now, Moses learned his lesson, I think. He did it. He did exactly what God had said this time. He made a model out of metal, stuck it on the pole so that people could look at it, and in fact, it worked. Every time anyone was bitten by the snake and looked at the model of the snake on the pole, they lived. In most of your translations, it will say bronze. The Hebrew word could be translated copper. There are copper mines about 10 miles away from where this happened, and of course, copper is that kind of reddish tinge. So a lot of people would say it was actually made out of copper rather than out of bronze, but it doesn't really matter. So God's given this solution. Why? It's a bit of an unusual thing, isn't it? Why did he use this particular method? Well, there are some reasons. One reason is the whole principle of sacrifice, where something stands for something else. And quite often you'll see that the opposite thing, you get the opposite thing in the sacrifice. So the death of an animal allows for the life of the person who the sacrifice is made for. A death for a life, or blood for cleansing. Blood makes you impure, but the blood makes you clean. So there's this kind of principle in sacrifice that the opposite has the result. The normally polluting or unclean thing can purify. And maybe that's what was happening here. The image of a poisonous snake can bring healing. But there's something else, and that is that snakes were quite well known in Canaanite mythology and in Canaanite society. Most people would wear amulets for protection, kind of magical necklaces and bracelets and brooches and things. And one of the most common, because there were a lot of poisonous snakes, was an image of a snake that people would wear. I've got the image of the snake, it's going to keep the bad snake, the real snake, away. And so that was actually something that they were quite familiar with as an idea. And what's interesting is that God kind of tapped into that cultural way of thinking. In Canaanite society, people would wear amulets. They would also have this idea of looking to a snake. But they would look to snakes to pray. They would see them as objects of worship or objects of power. And what's quite interesting is that here's one, a copper snake, dug up from a place about 15 miles north of Eilat, which is just about where Kadesh Barnea is, which was found in a Midianite tabernacle, a place called Timnah. This is in about 1976. And it's got this kind of gold head on it, which is worn away a little bit. There actually were copper snakes around there in the area. This one's been dated to 1300 BC, would you believe? Which is just about the right sort of time. So it's quite interesting. Here's one. Do you think this is the one? Do you think this is the snake that Moses made, lifted up on the pole, and they actually buried it away somewhere in the desert? Of course, we know it isn't. It actually isn't. We know that for sure. Because if you look in 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 1 to 5, we find that good old King Hezekiah, or actually good young King Hezekiah, when he was doing his reforms, he decided there were all sorts of things that the Israelites were doing wrong, one of which, where am I, 18 verse 1, let's go to verse 4. Hezekiah removed the high places, broke the pillars, cut down the Asherah, and he broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. Right up to those days, the people of Israel were burning incense to it. And they'd given it the name Nehushtan. It had become an image of idolatry, this thing that God had given them as deliverance. They'd taken it, they kept it for hundreds of years, and they were worshipping it. King Hezekiah said, not having any of that, and he destroyed it. So we do know that this one that they dug up isn't the one, but it was perhaps a little bit like this. And there is, of course, a warning for us here, the tendency to worship the thing instead of worshipping God, that tendency to idolatry, to worship the means of deliverance instead of worshipping the deliverer. And that's the basis, of course, of religion. Wrong religion, that's what I mean. So what does this mean for us? Very quickly and very importantly. This story has particular importance for Christians because Jesus picked it up. And Jesus mentioned it several times and gave it a really important and deeper meaning. And if we turn to John chapter 3, we'll see where he does that. John chapter 3 and verse 14, Jesus said, "As Moses lifted up the snake in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man," his name for himself, "the Son of Man be lifted up, so that whoever believes in him may have eternal life." If we turn on a few pages extra to John 12, and John 12 verse 31, Jesus said, "Now is the judgment of this world, now shall the ruler of this world be cast out, and I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all men to myself." He said this to show by what death he was to die. Jesus said, this thing is an image of the cross. So we can learn some lessons about the death of Jesus on the cross from this thing that happened with the snake in the wilderness. This isn't some kind of super spiritual wrong application where we're ripping some verse out of context from the Old Testament and giving it all sorts of New Testament meanings that it doesn't really have. It's very easy to do that. But this is something Jesus said. Jesus ripped it out of the Old Testament and said, actually, this is important. This is about my death. This is about the cross. So what can we learn from the cross, about the cross, from the snake? There's all sorts of things we can learn. People bitten by the snake would die. It was a fatal condition. People who didn't look at the snake did die. The metal snake. The metal snake cured their fatal condition, but only for those who looked. There's a lesson for us. We have a fatal condition. We've been bitten. We've been bitten by the fatal condition of sin. And it will kill us if we don't do something. It is a fatal condition. There is a result, which is eternal separation from God. And that's not optional. It will happen unless we find God's solution. Unless we find the thing that God has given us to bring healing and deliverance. Jesus said that's his death on the cross. He said those who believe in him will have eternal life. They were healed by looking. They didn't have to go and touch it or pray to it or rub it on or do some sort of prayer to it. They didn't do anything. They just looked. It was a clear miracle. Looking at the snake brought them healing. Only God could do that. And only God can save sinful people. When we've been bitten, and we know we've been bitten, and it's a fatal and terminal condition, God has chosen to do that through the death of Jesus on the cross. The Israelites couldn't touch the metal snake. It was up on a pole. It was distant. And they didn't need to touch it. They just had to look and live. We can't touch the cross. It's in history. It's gone. We can look and live. It's an act of faith. We have to look to Jesus in faith for forgiveness and for salvation. The metal snake was an image of a real snake. The picture of the reality. The picture brought deliverance. It substituted for the real thing. The deadly thing became the instrument of healing. And on the cross, Jesus did something quite amazing. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, for our sake, God made Jesus to be sin, to be sin. He became the snake who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Galatians 3, verse 13. Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become himself a curse for us. He became the thing that he delivered us from. And the last thing I think is important is that the metal snake didn't stop anybody getting bitten. It was there. People still got bitten. But it did bring healing for those who were bitten and looked. And it's important for us to know too that the cross of Jesus that happened 2,000 years ago doesn't stop sinning. Sin still happens. We still do it, although we desperately wish we didn't. But it does offer forgiveness and redemption to those of us who look to Jesus. It's a really powerful image. And we're not over-spiritualizing it. We're taking what Jesus did, which is to say, there's the real event. Look at what it tells you about the way I'm going to die. So let's just finish. We've all been bitten by sin. The inevitable consequences await us unless we look and live. Numbers 20 and 21 marks a turning point in the story of Israel. After 40 years, they're finally on the way. They've got back to the place which is the entry point into Canaan. They're about to enter the land that God has promised them. None of the original generation that left Egypt are going to enter. Not even Moses or Aaron or Miriam, because of disobedience. What we need to learn is that God is holy, and we must take him seriously. We must be holy because he is holy. It's either a command or a promise. Either way, it's there, and we can't ignore it. That there must be implications for our behaviour if we believe that God is holy. And the metal snake teaches us that in the midst of judgment, God provides a way of salvation. We've all been bitten by the poisonous snakes. Our problem is actually more serious than being bitten by a physical poisonous snake. Our problem is an eternal problem. But the cross provides the answer. The death of Jesus on the cross offers an answer to sin if we look and live. Let's pray together, shall we?